This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we talk with economics professor Rick Wolf about the population upheavals and demonstrations in France.
It's against austerity in France. Will we see those demonstrations here in the United States? Listen in.
In a surprising decision, the so-called Nuremberg Four were convicted on terrorism charges.
The charges stemmed entirely from the work of an undercover FBI informant. Would these people have allegedly committed any crimes without the informant? Certainly not.
Stay with us. Michael, we're not going to belabor the recent elections, but we hear that something unique happened in Oklahoma. Can you tell us?
Yes. Oklahoma, in its great wisdom, the voters in Oklahoma passed a new law telling the courts what kind of law they could look to when they decided cases and what kind of law they could not look to when they decided cases. So they amended the Oklahoma Constitution. And the law essentially says the courts can look at laws of the United States Code, federal regulations, common law, etc., and the laws of another state, as long as the laws of the other states that they look to do not include Sharia law or Muslim law. And then it goes on, the statute, that says the court shall not look to the legal precepts of other nations or cultures. Specifically, the court shall not consider international or Sharia law, and that they are to apply in all cases. This is now part of the Oklahoma Constitution. Incredible discrimination in this country and attacks on Muslims. This is another piece of it, and we can just see how bad the situation is, really, for people of the Muslim faith in the United States.
Let's hope other states don't follow suit.
People might ask, well, would they ever look at Sharia law? And the answer is, you know, they very well might. In a divorce proceeding between two people who were married under Sharia law and then getting divorced, the court does have the ability, and sometimes will, look at the laws under which they were married and divorced. Likewise, if there's a personal injury somewhere in another country, they'll look to the laws of another country to say what is the liability of people, and it might well include Sharia law. So it actually has, apart from being just prejudicial, it actually has a big effect on certain kinds of cases that will come in front of the court. And of course, international law, courts look to international law all the time, whether it's, you know, the Geneva Conventions or prohibitions on torture or whatever else. They stem from international law. So this is, what can you say about Oklahoma, except that it probably unfortunately reflects much of the country.
Data from the United States Bureau of Labor Statistics shows unemployment has risen further and faster in the United States than in France in the last 3 years. Yet, French workers are in the streets by the millions, demonstrating against anti-worker austerity policies. In California alone, there is now 22% unemployment, and it takes the average unemployed American about 35 weeks to find a job. U.S. states and towns cut payrolls and public services as President Obama's special commission gets ready to reduce Social Security benefits to the American people. We're delighted to have back with us economics professor Rick Wolf, who joins us in the studio.
Rick, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for inviting me.
Rick, a few months ago, I know you were in France, and on this program, you correctly predicted that a combination of French unions, leftists, and others would really oppose so-called austerity measures, not so-called, austerity measures in France. And of course, your prediction came true, which we feel really good about having you on the show. But can you give us a sense now of what's really happening in France? How meaningful is it?
Sure. First, let me mention that when I met with some of the organizers of these events last summer, basically in July of this year, I can assure you from the way they were talking that they have been as surprised by the reaction they've gotten from the French people as any observer outside has been. This is a tsunami of political movement. You have the following things that have coalesced. First of all the six different national federations of trade unions have unified around organizing and moving these demonstrations. They haven't unified on anything for a long time. That's already significant. Number two, they have drawn in students it's predictable perhaps that the left wing, the Communist Party, the anti-capitalist, there's two of those in France, parties, and good sections of the left wing of the Socialist Party, they swung in behind the unions. That perhaps isn't so surprising given their long network of connections. What is more impressive are two other facts that make this a political movement of enormous power. First, 3 or 4 weeks in, Sarkozy, who had been predicting there would be no opposition to his moves, who then predicted it wouldn't last more than a few days, who then predicted it would be isolated to just the trade unions, almost in a way provoked the high school and college students to join in huge numbers, which surprised the French public since the struggle is ostensibly about retirement, which happens when you're ancient, and therefore would not have high school and college kids all that interested. The high school and college kids quickly understood that if the old people have to stay in their jobs an extra 2 years, that's jobs they're not going to get. And in an environment of unemployment, it became crystal clear, as all their placards show, that they have to make common cause with the trade unions, which they now have done in huge numbers. So you get the following result. The IFOP, which is the French equivalent of the Gallup poll, polls every week twice the French public about these events. Been going on now for 8.5 weeks. In September, they got 70% of the people in France either indicating they were supportive or sympathetic to the demonstrations and the strikers. And the 70% has been consistent straight through right until this week. They had the last one on the 25th, which was Monday of this week. So you get not only huge demonstrations, and I'll get to their size in a minute, but you get even more important, 70% of the French people support it. Even over the last 2 or 3 weeks when gasoline supplies were interrupted at the refineries, and about a third of the gas stations in France had no gas. And, you know, particularly for people in more rural areas, this is a major problem, both as farming, and remember France has a big farming sector, and, you know, local people. France has a very good public transportation system, so that saves it a little bit. But nonetheless, it was one of those moments when the inconvenience of having no transportation in many areas did not do anything to the mass support for this.
Let me ask one question. I know you want to go into a little more detail, but here we're speaking to you on October 27th, and a couple of days ago I saw the French, whatever they call it, assembly or parliament, assembly, did pass the law that raised the pension from 60 to 62 years old, and in the face of this opposition. So I'm just trying to get, if the opposition is so strong and 70% of the people are with it, what happened?
Good question. Let me give the fact of the matter. The proposal, the law that passed, it had to pass first the National Assembly and then the Senate. Those are the two bodies of the French legislature. It passed the Assembly some weeks ago, and then it has to be read by the Senate, and they just passed it too. The law stipulates that if you want a full pension, that's postponed from age 65, which it was, to age 67. If you're willing to accept the partial pension, it's really quite like Social Security, then you can do it at age 60, but the new law will push that back to 62. Some of the representations in the American press that they can retire at full pension at age 60, that's wrong.
Right, that's what I actually thought.
Yeah, right. No, you would think that, because if you read the American press, including our major newspapers, they get this mangled and bumbled all the time, although that's the least of the damage they've done to anything, any notion of objective press reporting. The government in power now is the Sarkozy government that was elected, whatever it was, a couple years ago, really before the crisis hits. It was a conservative government, and he was swept into power because of anger at the old socialists for not having functioned very well, which they largely deserved. That is, the opposition not voting for Mr. Sarkozy. So he controls both houses of the legislature, that is the conservative parties. However, in the most recent national election, very early this year, which was voting for the departments in France, instead of calling each thing a state the way we do, they call them départements or departments. In 21 out of the 22 departments, in the last national election, a coalition of the left that includes Socialist Party, Communist Party, Green Party, and Anti-Capitalist Party won. He only won 1 out of 22, amazing, which was already the first sign that the man's popularity is going to rival George Bush in the last 4 months of his term. So what we see now is a minority government, isolated, entrenched, overwhelmed by the popular opinion that indicates the vast majority have no liking for this guy at all. So you're watching a lame duck government, as everybody in France knows, carrying through. Only the New York Times would publish articles as if this was a government that was in some sense representative of the people, and that therefore there was this split in France society in which the majority supported the government. Any reasonable understanding of where the elections of the last 12 months have gone would understand that this is a rump government whose days are numbered. And by the way, just for the record, I would not be surprised, personally, just my judgment, if the business community in France finally said to Mr. Sarkozy, have a nice day, but do it somewhere else, because he's useless to them. The job of a French president is to govern a peaceful, docile, productive French population that generates the lovely profits that large corporations are used to. The last thing on earth they want is a nasty, small, he's a short guy, provocative president who provokes demonstrations and strikes, which bring to back into French politics an enormous, unified, organized, militant left. I mean, just to give you one dimension, France has a right wing just as we do. They have the equivalent of tea parties, although they tend to call them fascists. We seem to hesitate in this country. and they have a base. They're very anti-immigrant. They have an ugly right wing political life. But they've been completely swamped. They don't make the newspapers on the 18th page because the left has re-entered French politics on a scale and with a power and with a popularity. It shows that the best antidote to a right wing having influence in a society is to give them some real stiff competition, in which case no one even remembers them.
Let's follow some of the strands, because this is pretty important. First, there's a strand of Europe, austerity, and what's happening economically, and then there's the strand of the United States. And why isn't this happening in the United States? I mean, there's been people trying to say, well, maybe it'll happen, maybe this will happen, but why isn't it? So I'm interested in both
the comparison
of those questions.
All right. Let me start with the French. In the newspapers in the United States, it is said that this is all about the proposal to push back retirement for 2 years. That has certainly been the government's position. They interpret that as all the spokesmen and women for the federal, for the Sarkozy government, want that to be believed. And the reason is that it is reasonable in the minds of most people, including most working people. Well, you know, we're having hard times. It's a difficult economy. Isn't it kind of reasonable if everybody has to kind of tighten their belt that we ask the old people to stay? After all, we're all living healthier and longer lives. So the reasonableness of this has been put forward. Let me respond to that in two ways. One, no way are you going to get a consistent 1.5 to 3 million French men and women out in the streets. And by the way, that's the range. The conservative government, 1.5, 1.3 million. The exuberant unionists and students, 3 million. No one will ever know which it is. But let's just take the low number, 1.5 million. 1.5 million in France. France has 1/5 the population of the United States. 60 million there, 300 million here. An equivalent number of people, if you take the low number, 1.5, would therefore be 7.5 million people in the streets. We've never had that in the history of the United States on any issue, right, left, or center. So if you want to see a movement that is really doing something and mobilizing mass opinion, you got it. And for all those who thought whether they wanted there never to be such a kind of left eruption into politics, or they felt they would like it, but it was no longer possible given the media, given everything else, here is proof positive that in the modern day and age, an advanced industrial economy, a left wing can coalesce and re-enter politics in a stunning way. The point of this, the people in France are not going into the streets because of 2-year extension of the retreat, of the retirement. It's called retraite in France. They're going in because they've had it with the whole crisis. That's why this is a powerful movement, and that's why it's relevant to the United States. If you read what the French are actually saying, it's really this. We've already paid for the crisis in unemployment, lost homes, insecure jobs. You know, in Europe, in France, they don't refer to the working class as the proletariat the way they used to. It's now called the précariat, the precarious. le précariat, the precarious ones, all of us with insecure jobs and benefits. So they have said, we've already suffered the crisis. We have already suffered watching our government respond to the crisis that affects us all by bailing out the banks, the big corporations, and not helping us. We've accepted that. We've done our part. We now draw a line in the sand. We are not going to pay for fixing this mess from which we have suffered, which we did not cause, and after you have already bailed out those who did cause it. That's it. That's enough. And that's what mobilizes the French to come out in huge numbers. Why is this relevant? Because it's exactly like the United States. The mass of Americans have, in fact, had a harder time. The statistics are clear. The growth in unemployment in the United States was much twice the size of the growth in France. The foreclosure movement in this country is many times larger than anything comparable in France. So the irony is the French have drawn a line in the sand, having suffered less in toto than the American working class by comparison. But the issues are the same. The American working class has suffered from the crisis. The American working class had nothing to do with bringing it about. Number three, the American working class has now watched as Citibank and Bank of America and AIG, General Motors, and all the others have been bailed out with hundreds of billions, trillions of dollars.
But you gave some explanation for this last time.
Absolutely. But the point I want to make is they've watched all this while their unemployment continues to be unaddressed. 7 million unemployed in December of 2007, 15.5 million unemployed today. Nothing's been done. There's no recovery in unemployment. There's no bailout of those people. It's extraordinary. And so the American working class has exactly the same issues. So why the difference? Here's my guess. When I went to France, I noticed something. The trade union leaders and activists, the left-wing party people, the student radicals, they know each other. They've done things together. They've even argued against each other in countless public forums. But they are organized. They have movements and organizations, and they have an organizational life, and they have organizational connections. When a mass movement has something around which to coalesce, it needs not only the issue, but the linkages, the connections, the personal, even if you like, relationships, one with another around this or that issue, we don't have that. The atrophy of the left in the last 50 years here is much more palpable than what happened there. We've had a much worse decline of our trade union movement than they did. We've had an atrophy of left-wing movements much more severe than they, and they've had it in France, but not on a scale like this. So what you have, the difference, I think, is that we have to create anew the organizations that could bring people together into an effective political coalition. They already had those organizations, and therein lies the difference, not some cultural enjoyment of French people who like to go into the streets. The French people are every bit as individualist as the Americans, probably more so. They don't do things easily in the street. That's a myth. They have been willing on major historic occasions to do that, but that's not so different from the United States has been willing to have, by the way, much more violent strikes in the history of the United States than ever the French had.
But what seems to be happening here is people like those who took the streets in France, in many ways, are going to be trying to say, let's boot the Democrats out. And it would seem to be, in some way, while I'm not saying it's in their interest to keep Obama and his crew in there, but it's not necessarily in their interest to put the Republicans in either.
No, clearly. It's crazy. But I would use the same argument. In the United States, there's no other organizations. If you don't like who's in, you vote for the other one, the only other organized political movement, and you put them in. That's what the American working people are doing. They're so upset by what Obama didn't do or what he did do and shouldn't have done that they're going to sit on their hands and give the election over to the Republicans or even vote for the Republicans. But it's not because they like the Republicans or trust them. All the polls indicate that. They're just angry at the Democrats. Oh, by the way, Mr. Obama got in large part because they were furious at the Republicans. And again, you notice if you only have those two organizations, then they mobilize the people's attitudes for their own ends. If there were a left alternative organized in the United States that could offer another way of expressing your discontent with the conditions of the world that we live in, I think you would see in the United States, maybe not as big, maybe not as fast as in France, but you would also see the same movement because the same conditions are facing the same people over the same period of time. It's naive to imagine that we couldn't or wouldn't have a constituency for a left that could organize its way into offering an alternative.
Well, Rick Wolf, what are you personally doing to try to construct that left alternative?
To take advantage of a change in American political sensibilities. All the attention is on the Tea Party, and I understand that, because they are an organized expression of something new and different on the political horizon, at least for the right, and the Republicans have so far been willing to go. So I want to tell everyone who's listening that my own personal life, the sheer number of invitations I get to appear in television programs, radio programs, and I'm talking about AM commercial stations all over the United States, because with the wonders of radio, Skype, and the electronic world, it's possible to be in all these places. I can assure you that the left of American political life has also changed. I am allowed to say what I have to say. I am a critic of capitalism, not just of this crisis or this detail or what the banks got, but of the whole system, something that's been taboo to discuss in this country for half a century. I'm out there. I'm talking about it. If you want a summary of what I basically say, it's something like this. America can do better than capitalism. And the interesting thing is I keep getting the invitations, and I can tell you one other thing. Having done these interviews all my life, I'm used to interviewer, man or woman, being very careful during the interview to show the distance between himself or herself on the one hand and me. They pat themselves on the back for being liberal and open enough to invite a person like me, but that is a way of making sure that the audience doesn't get angry at them. All that's gone. I'm being pitched softballs that give me a chance to make my argument. And the interviewer isn't my enemy, isn't my adversary, isn't distant, wants to associate himself or herself with my views. The last one I did was a radio station in Salt Lake City. A gentleman who invited me, he said with real intensity, "Amen, brother." Because of what I had just said, I think it was about the housing disaster and the foreclosure and all that, but it's a different, I can assure you, it's a different attitude out there. I'm not saying they agree with me all the time. Far from it. But I have a perspective that is no longer outside the range of possible opinion.
You went back and said about the failure of trade unions and the left, and I don't know if you were at it or if you have any perspective. You know, there was this demonstration in Washington a few weeks ago by some organized labor, the NAACP and others. And the reports I heard back, I mean, other than you may have read a better editorial about it in The Nation or in some other places, but most of my friends who were there said it was essentially the last, a dying gasp of the labor unions. You couldn't mention anti-war, and they were really disappointed in it. And it does seem to me, from what you're saying, it didn't take any position at all regarding what really might be going on in this country. But I don't know if you've talked about that.
Yeah, I've talked to a variety of people. I've heard that opinion, but I've also heard some other opinions, which is it always starts small in the United States. So there were whatever, 800,000 or whatever the numbers were that gathered. Given recent American history, that's already an achievement.
Well, they were all bussed in by unions. But,
granted,
you know,
but they hadn't done that either. Yeah, I mean, well, think of a country that has doubled its unemployment from 7 to 15 million. And over the last 18 months that it's roughly been at that level, nothing. It's extraordinary. The unions could have, they have the money to bus in some people to make some sort of noise. They're terrified that Obama will be defeated.
Well, and I think that's the big problem
with
what happened.
Yes, they don't want to break with that. They don't want to help the Republicans in any conceivable way. They're frightened, as they should be. But I think it's a slow process. I was struck that when the difficult decision came, you know, the October 2nd event in Washington was organized by the NAACP and the AFL-CIO. When they were approached by more leftist groups, for example, the Socialist Party of the U.S., who asked that they be able to carry their own placards and participate and be public, there was some discussion. You could feel the tension, but they agreed to do that, and they went, and other little groups could come and participate. So it's a small step. I don't want to exaggerate it. And compared to France, it is very puny. On the other hand,
something is beginning. And even people who want to control these things, one of the reasons we don't have them more in the United States is the fear of those who arrange them that they will lose control to a groundswell of opinion. And I think the unions are exactly at that point. They have masses of their members and people that work in their enterprises where they're strong who want them to do much more than they're doing, and they don't know quite how to do that. And that's part of what's going to be fought out.
Do you think what's happening in France is instructive to a lot of these, to the unions and activists?
Oh, yes, absolutely. First of all, in Europe, I mean, everywhere in Europe, there are endless debates now about the applicability of what the French are doing to Britain, to Ireland, to Italy, to Spain, to Portugal. I mean, I don't think there's a single left labor organization and community in any European country that where that isn't a prime topic of conversation now. It's gone too far. It's lasted too long. The ability of the French to win this kind of mass political support, you're getting, I mean, I don't want to be mean spirited, but even the more opportunistic politicians are beginning to sniff. The wind has changed. It's not so good to be supporting austerity as the necessary thing we need to do. It's now looking like that's a death trip in your political future, and you're beginning to get all kinds of people you wouldn't have thought of it coming out with sentences. Now, everybody's watching, right? The French, it's a confrontation. It may well become a constitutional crisis, this minority government and mass opposition. And the French is not the place where you want to do that. They do have a history of having nasty thoughts about their leadership when it goes too far. I'll give you one example. Obama organized something called the Deficit Reduction Commission. It was organized some months ago and is expected to give a report right after the election. It's widely rumored by economists that I know personally who are close to these things that their plan is to announce a postponement of Social Security retirement age in this country exactly like what Sarkozy did. And I have recently learned that they, too, are now worried about inadvertently provoking here something that seemed to come out of nowhere over there. So the ramifications of what's happening are changing all political calculations.
Well, Rick, what can we all do, not only personally, but organizationally? How do you pull things together? I do agree with you. The left has atrophied over the last half a century. I look back when the unions were busted up in 1949 and radicals were driven out. And it's really been pretty much, except for various movements in the 60s, kind of all downhill. And how do we take a step forward now? It seems to me that we're really fragmented. The one report I got from the Washington demonstration that the socialists were all, various socialist organizations, marched together. That was encouraging to me. What do they need to do?
Well, my own judgment, and I'm doing a little of this myself, is basically to follow out the logic of what I said. If we don't have organizations, if that's the key difference between what we have and what the French are able to do, then the job for all of us is to build new organizations and to start modestly with a handful of people and begin to do it. Since none of us knows the magic bullet of how to do this, if we can avoid the kind of sectarianism in which small groups pretend that they really do know and others are all wrong, which has a terrible history in our country, if we can get around that, then I am very confident that if we try each place everywhere, we will produce, after through trial and error, the organizational framework that might allow us to move forward. But that there is no substitute for that. It should be done in the trade union movement, in the workplace, in the best ways those people can think of moving, in the universities that way, in the communities that way, in the ethnic minority areas that way, however people want. If they are open to the kind of broad coalescing, the last thing we need is 800 little single-issue groups, each one cultivating its own garden and not talking to the other, because that will keep us as relatively powerless as we have been for 50 years.
What are the three things Obama could do tomorrow to at least remedy some of the problems?
First thing he could do is take a page from Franklin Roosevelt's book. If in 1933 or 4, Roosevelt went on the radio and he said, if the private sector either cannot or will not hire people, we in the government will. Between 1934 and 1941, Roosevelt created 11 million jobs. And they transformed the United States, and they put those millions of people to work. They had a decent job. They had a decent income. They could maintain their mortgage payments. The first thing Obama could do, which would overnight make him a hero the way Roosevelt became when he did it, is to put those people into a useful job, rebuilding our cities, rebuilding the infrastructure that we complain about. Do it fast, do it quickly, show a commitment that really transforms masses of people's lives.
So rather than print money to buy bonds,
absolutely,
the Federal Reserve should print money to give people jobs, right?
Look, it's called in economics, we have a term, but it's pushing on a string. It doesn't go anywhere. You bail out the banks. You give them tons of money to get the credit system going. The banks have said to the United States, thank you very much for bailing us out. Thank you very much for the money. But of course, we're not going to lend it to people and businesses because that's what got us into trouble a minute ago. That would be imprudent banking, they've suddenly learned. So they've held on to the money. You can't keep doing that when it doesn't work. It didn't put people back to work. You begged, you asked, you cajoled, you threatened. But if you don't do anything, then the threat has no meaning anymore. So the first thing he should do is act clearly to help the mass of people and hope that it trickles up into our economy rather than counting on the old trickling down from helping those who, after all, as we now know from this latest home foreclosure fiasco, didn't even do the paperwork appropriate to the thievery that they were about.
All right, Rick, thanks. It was fabulous as usual. Good for our country what you're saying, but thank you.
I do think in one last word that the French events, whatever the outcome, have already taught us the possibilities of political action, the ability of a left to reconstitute itself and become a major force in society. That ought to give us some pause. The French are not that different from us. What they did there is a potential we should not miss trying to realize here.
That was excellent. Just excellent.
Really, really great.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. In a case that could define when a permissible sting operation becomes legal entrapment, four men were convicted of planting bombs outside Bronx synagogues and plotting to fire missiles at military planes. The so-called Newburg Four are four African Americans from Newburg, New York, with prior records for nonviolent offenses. They were approached by a government agent provocateur, Shahed Hussein, who himself was facing imprisonment. He offered them money, food, marijuana, cars, and vacations, ultimately coercing the four to collaborate on a so-called terror plot. We're joined today by Steve Downs, a volunteer attorney on the Yasin Aref case. Welcome, Steve, to Law and Disorder. Many of us were actually stunned by last week's decision because we thought this was a clear-cut case of an informant perhaps going too far. Were you surprised?
Yeah, we really were surprised. We thought maybe the edge had been reached here, that there was going to be some kind of a boundary line drawn, and apparently that's not. Apparently this problem is going to continue to spread.
Why don't you give us some details first of what was the jury result in the Newburg 4 case, and what was some of the highlights of the informant testimony? Let's start with the result.
Well, the result was that they were convicted of participating in this plot that had been entirely cooked up, manufactured by the FBI. These were four individuals who had no way to undertake any kind of a terrorist plot. They had no automobile, no driver's license. They had no money. They had no training. They had nothing. And the FBI simply provided everything, including driving them to the spot. So all they had to do was to deliver a package outside of a building to complete this crime, which the FBI had concocted. There's just no other way to look at it. And if this is an entrapment, and I think what a lot of people are saying is if this isn't entrapment, then we just don't have entrapment anymore.
Well, Steve, isn't the definition of entrapment that it's not entrapment if the defendants are predisposed to do it?
Well, There is the predisposition idea, and that comes from the ready response argument. And I think that that has simply been misused where the entrapment cases originally came up. These were in the drug cases. The person was essentially being asked or enticed to do something that was inherently illegal, like buying drugs. So if you went to somebody and you said, hey, would you like to buy some drugs? And the guy says, sure, that's great. The person who entered into that would know immediately that what they were being asked to do was something that was illegal. In this particular case, the government kind of sidestepped that, and I just want to first deal with some of the other cases, and then I'll come back to this one. In a lot of the other cases, what they're essentially being asked to do is to, for example, would you like a loan, $5,000, or a gift of $5,000? Then only later, afterwards, do you find out that this gift maybe has to do with money laundering, it comes from a terrorist transaction or something, but in the meantime, the person is being asked to make a ready response to something which isn't inherently illegal. And I think that's one of the major issues. That was certainly the problem in our case up in Albany. Now, down there in the Newberg case, they had a situation where this Shahid Hussein, the informant, suggested a inherently illegal plot, and then the main person in that he was working on, James Cromedy, essentially backed out of it, said he did not want to do this. There was a six-week period, he didn't correspond with the government at all. And then finally, Shahid Hussein gets on the phone and says, look, you got $250,000 here. If you go through with this, $250,000. Now, that's a huge inducement, and that is not a ready response. He had already listened to the idea, backed out of it, and then was offered $250,000 to keep going. So I would suggest that all of those things would overcome any suggestion that there was a ready response.
And isn't it true that the four individuals that he approached were from an impoverished community upstate? They had had minor records, were perhaps vulnerable to someone who was promising this amount of money, and didn't he offer a BMW as well?
Yes. Oh, yeah. There was a lot of offers made. At one point, he offered somebody to buy him a barber shop. At another time, there was offers made to help with his brother or his nephew's cancer treatment. There were a lot of money, a lot of offers, the BMW. All of these things were sort of thrown around. But the people, the particular that were targeted here, were very vulnerable people. These were people that had become somewhat exposed to Islam in prison, but did not know much about the religion. They were not, in some cases, practicing Muslims. They had other problems, like one of them had a crack cocaine problem. Another one had mental problems, very serious mental problems, actually. Another one was homeless for a while. These are people that were very susceptible to money offers and to the certain grandiosity that all of this was offered to them. You could have gone to almost any part of a city, upstate New York, and found people that would have been willing to grab at a deal like this. It was money, a lot of money, for potentially very little activity, just delivering a package outside a building.
Didn't they know that the building was a synagogue and the package would blow up?
Oh, yeah. No, that was clearly the part of the idea, although, interestingly, the way it was structured, the bomb was going to go off at night, so the building might be destroyed, but they were not going to kill anybody. The same was true of shooting down the planes. The planes were going to be on the ground, not operating, when they were shot at, so that the men, I think, understood that nobody was going to be injured. This would be a statement against the Jews, against whoever it is, the army. It was clearly an illegal and improper plot, what was being proposed. But one in which they were essentially being paid a lot of money to make a political statement, not to kill anybody.
And if this had happened before the events of 9/11, then that distinction of whether harm was going to be done to a human being might have made a big difference. But now that meets terrorism standards.
Yes, that's right. These things are very, very cleverly crafted by the FBI. It's a scenario. And they manage to work in every little piece that they can. They use a missile because that enhances the sentence. They make sure that there's videos of the people delivering the package and so on. But the dynamics of what happens here, how the Shahid Hussein, who is a brilliant con man, how he is able to work on people's emotions and become let them become involved in this group that has high purposes for a bunch of people that are down and out and don't seem to be going anywhere, and that that motivates people to go and do things that perhaps they otherwise wouldn't do. This is what con men do.
My reaction to this, and I like your comment, is that this just keeps that, you know, fear factor cranking up. But for the anti-Muslim prejudice that's so prevalent in the country today, this couldn't have never happened.
Well, I agree with that. I think in part that is the purpose of this, is to keep the fear factor up. I can't believe that anybody in the government actually believes that getting these guys to come down to go to jail in any way makes the country safer. It doesn't.
It seems just so made up to me. I have to, you know, if the informant who's saying, if he hadn't been around, these guys would have just led their lives. I mean, nothing would have happened. So the whole thing is just made up from the beginning. And why would the government ever make it up from the beginning rather than try and find people who are actually committing crimes? I just can't figure it out. What was going on?
Well, I think initially, right after 9/11, the administration, frankly, I think panicked and just didn't know whether there were a real terrorist in the country or not. And they started a very aggressive program, which preemptive prosecution, in which they tried to identify anybody that might be a security risk and then went after them and tried to manufacture, create a crime that they could convict them of to preempt them from actually getting involved in anything down the road. And they were very open about this. I mean, that's exactly the language they used in describing our case up in Albany, you know, that we didn't think he was a terrorist, but he might have cooperated with terrorists. And so in order to preempt that, we went through and did this crazy sting with the same Shahid Hussein.
It's amazing.
Those are their exact words. Now, I think at some point that kind of got out of control as the FBI began to realize that you made careers by going out and finding slow-witted people, people that were vulnerable, and talking them into crimes, and then you could pretend that you had just arrested the greatest terrorist in the world, and then you got promoted. There was a whole culture of that that's being developed in the FBI. And I think there's also the idea that if you keep the Muslim community scared most of the time, they will start to turn in more terrorists if they come along.
Tell us about the jury composition.
You know, I didn't follow it closely enough to know. I don't think, I talked to some of the lawyers down there. I don't think they had any particular concerns about the jury. They seem to be a fairly cross section of America. Certainly up in our case, here in Albany, we had a fairly typical cross-section of people. I could talk more about our jury, I think, perhaps, than the one down there, but I do remember going through jury questionnaires and looking at them, and I was astonished to find that in that jury questionnaire, there was a lot of questions about how much do you know about Islam, how much do you know about various things involving the Middle East, and for the most part, almost nobody had any idea about Islam or much about the politics of the Middle East. In other words, it was a jury made up of often of professionals, of teachers, engineers, and things like that. It was educated but not sophisticated about Islam. And that also, I think, is part of the problem, that because people don't know much about Islam, the government is free to play on the kind of stereotypes and fears that people have, and they just don't have enough sophistication to be able to understand it.
I know that while the deliberations were going on, there was this issue came up that in the jury books, somebody had, whether intentionally or inadvertently, put in phone conversations that some of the defendants had had with their parents or their father or mother, I don't recall. It was material that the judge had not allowed into the trial. And so some jurors had apparently read this. And as a result, the defendants asked for a mistrial. The judge, instead of doing that, simply got rid of one of the jurors who claimed that she couldn't put what she read outside of her deliberations.
Right.
What's the story with that, and how good of issue is that going up?
Well, you know, potentially I would think this is a great issue. What happened was, and on the stand, Shahid Hussein got really beaten up. This is a you hate to say it, call people psychotic liars, but he fits this profile of a person that simply cannot tell the truth. And some of the lies that he told over this very long period of cross-examination were just astonishing, actually, to the point where the trial judge was saying that she may have to refer this out for perjury prosecution. At this point, I think the government had to be kind of concerned about it. And so there is a suggestion that in slipping this stuff in, or in having this stuff inserted, the government might have been trying to get a mistrial.
Wow, that's interesting.
Interesting.
Yeah, I mean, because that would have been my take on it. I have never seen a witness as completely destroyed as Shahid Hussein was. The trial judge, McMahon, has been very hard on the prosecution. And it's one of the few times I've seen a trial where the trial judge forced the government to keep turning over more and more exculpatory information, which showed how very, very damaged their lead witness was. Because of how hard she was, she took to referring to the case as the unterrorism trial, for example. It does suggest that she may take some sort of an action based on that. She could throw out the verdict. She could do a sort of an investigation as to the motives of the government in putting this material in. I don't know that she's going to let it go, but, you know, it's hard once the jury verdict is in to do much about it. I don't hold a lot of hope for it.
Now, the informant in this case, Hussein, he was an informant in the trial you did in Albany as well, where you were defense counsel. Can you describe that trial and Hussein for us?
Yeah. In our case, we were representing the imam of a mosque here, and the government wanted to go after our guy, the imam. We don't know why. It's all shrouded in secrecy. But for various reasons, some of which they've put out and some of which I think they probably have not put out, they decided to concoct this sting in which they would have Hussein, at that point, I'll refer to him as Malik because that was how we knew him in the sting. Malik would go to a member of Yassin's mosque and pose as an arms merchant and say, I'm selling arms to my brothers. I'm going to sell a missile that's going to be used to assassinate the Pakistani ambassador to the United Nations, and when I get that money, I'll have $50,000. I can loan it to you. And the Mohammed Hussein indicated clearly he didn't want to have anything to do with a terrorist plot. He was an American citizen. He loved America. He loved being in this country. He didn't want anything to do with terrorists, but he sure needed the money for his business. So he agreed to go along with that. Now, remember, they're not targeting Mohammed Hussein. They don't care about him. They didn't even ask for bail for him. He was out on bail the whole time. They were never worried about him. They were trying to get Yassin, Aref. So then they managed to get Yassin Aref to come in to witness the loan transaction. And that was his only involvement with this, was in the loan transaction. And the only question was at the trial whether or not, while he was witnessing a series of loan transactions, there were six meetings, enough information was given to Yassin to suggest to him that he was witnessing what amounted to a money laundering transaction. That was how it was. As I read through the evidence, it was obvious to me that Hussein and Malik, the government informant, was attempting to insert into the record material which could be used at trial to show that Yassin knew the information, but in fact Yassin did not know it or did not hear it. In other words, it's a setup. He was being framed.
And that was the same informant, of course, in that trial that then later was so deeply involved in the Newburgh Four.
Yes. And for example, I'll just give you one example of it. Yassin was only convicted of the last series of conversations, the last conversation on June 10th, and there was a series of conversations there.
That's your client in the Albany trial, right?
Yes. Yeah. And that was the only counts that he was convicted of. And the only question about that conversation, it was conducted in code, in which the word Chowdhury was used for missile, so that Malik would say, I send Chowdhurys to New York, I get money for them, I can make a loan to you. If you didn't know what the word Chowdhury meant, it meant missile in this code language, then, of course, the conversation wouldn't mean anything to you. And the question was Yassin ever told what the meaning of the word Chowdhury was? Well, the government backed and filled and so on and took positions, but, in fact, no one ever testified that they told him what the meaning of the word was. And so, I mean, this would have been a classic way of getting somebody involved in an incriminating conversation without their being aware of it. I mean, these are examples of things I'm just showing.
So now with the Newburgh Four, there's obviously going to be motions for a mistrial, a new trial. I mean, and I presume the four defendants are in jail?
Four defendants are in jail, yes. I think they have an excellent defense team down there. I think they're fully committed to getting this thing appealed. We came out of our trial up here in Albany feeling very confident. We had many, many good appealable issues, and we hit a brick wall, frankly. And I just want to mention what had happened. When we got there, we submitted our brief, and the government, of course, submitted their brief.
This is in the Court of Appeals, you mean?
This is in the circuit court, yeah.
Right.
And then the government submitted a secret brief that we were not allowed to see. Then the government submitted a top secret brief, which even the prosecutor wasn't allowed to see. They had a public argument, and then we were excused, and the government got to argue in secret before the circuit court. And the circuit court gives us a decision that was just a brick that either ignored our issues or mischaracterized them. It was a disaster. So I think at some level, the appellate courts have been persuaded that these are national security issues, there are national security issues involved in them, and that they should not give them the same level of review that they would in other cases.
I think that's right. I think the Second Circuit has been terrible on these issues, as we know.
Yeah. One of the issues in the case was the illegal surveillance that had gone on under NASA. And in our case, it happens the NASA program was under challenge at one point, and somebody from the administration got up and said, well, it's a great program. It helped catch an imam in Albany, New York, Yassin Arif. So we were probably the one person in the whole country that could show that we were actually illegally wiretapped. And so that was one of the issues that went up to the Second Circuit. And the Second Circuit said, well, we actually don't have to decide that issue because you cannot raise a colorable claim that you were illegally wiretapped. So notwithstanding that an administration spokesman had said that we were the subject of an illegal wiretap, couldn't raise that as a colorable claim to get the court to decide it. That was the level, and I think at that point we sort of threw up our hands. I threw up my hands and sort of said, if the court is taking that position, they're essentially saying nobody could ever raise this issue, and that's because it's a national security issue, and they're not going to touch it.
Attorney Steve Downs, is there a way for our listeners to reach your Salaam project? You have a website that you want to share with us?
Oh, yes, we do have a Project Salaam website. It's just the words project, Project Salaam, one word, salaam.org. And we have our information up there. What we're trying to do is document and analyze cases of preemptive prosecution in the country. This is where the government tries to convict people of contrived crimes in order to prevent them from engaging possibly in cooperating with terrorists in the future. And there are literally hundreds of these cases all across the country. It's a mammoth job. We're getting pretty good traction with that now. We're having a number of organizations that are trying to get together and work on it because they realize that although the issue right now is confined somewhat to the Muslim community, it is already leaking out and going into other kinds of communities. The government has been targeting environmentalists, for example, using somewhat the same theories. And now they're going after peace activists using somewhat the same theories. So we feel this is a very dangerous time for civil rights in the United States.
Thank you so much for being with us.
It's really profound what you're doing. Thank you very much, Steve Downs, for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, or hear a segment you've missed, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. Now you should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook. Become a friend and send Law and Disorder to your friends through Facebook. Thank you.
Thank you.